5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program.
I'm able to live my life and still hit my goals.
Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
Is it a crisis? Hi, I'm Jarvis Smith, and my new show, Lean Into Clean, will inspire, impress, and inform. What can we all do to clean up our lives so the next generations and, of course, our beautiful planet can thrive? Perhaps we've all lost our way. Lean Into Clean will showcase how we might remember, refocus, and restore the natural way so we can again live in balance and harmony with life on Earth and all its inhabitants. Welcome to this week's Leading Into Clean. As you know, I'm Jarvis Smith, co-founder of My Green Pod. We've got a treat for you today. So we've got our guest is Sir Jonathan Poet. And as you know, normally we would start with a bit of news. But because this guest is so important to us, I'm going to start with him today. So we're going to invite Sir Jonathan Poet straight to our interview stage. I just wanted to tell you one thing that I always do about our guests. This is what Wikipedia has to say. Sir Jonathan S.B. Poet, 2nd Baronet, is a British environmentalist and writer. He is known for his advocacy of the Green Party of England and Wales. Poet frequently contributes to magazines, newspapers and books and appears on radio and television. Jonathan, welcome to Lean Into Clean. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Yeah. And less of the sir, if you don't mind, Jarvis.
Of course. But I wanted to get it in so you tell me off for saying it. Thank you very much. I wanted to come back about that, actually, because it'd be quite interesting to see how you felt about that. But would you say that's a good description of you, how Wikipedia describes you? I mean, if our listeners wanted to get to know you, how would you describe yourself?
I guess it's a reasonable description. It's difficult to capture it in just a couple of sentences. I've been at it, at this whole green sustainability thing for nearly 50 years. So I don't envy anybody the challenge of trying to capture that in just a few words. But I guess the thing that listeners might be interested in is that during those 50 years, I've done literally every different way of trying to communicate about our fragile relationship with the earth and why we need to do things so differently. So as a campaigner, an author, a broadcaster, an advisor to government, advisor to business, you know, I've sort of tried the lot really at different points because nothing's quite worked yet, as it were.
I mean, firstly, thank you for trying all the different, as many different ways as you could. And I definitely want to pick up on that. Nothing's quite worked yet. I've known you for a good few years now. I would definitely consider you as one of my mentors in a sense that I've learned from the way that you've done things and read about you and the information that you have, not directly personal mentorship, but certainly you've been an inspiration to me. And thank you for that. I've got this label, and I'm sorry to label you, but I've got this label as activist. Would you consider yourself as being today an activist?
Yes.
Yes. Good.
I would. Although, you know, I guess that from a chronological point of view, the first half of my life as a green activist, which was the Green Party and Friends of the Earth,
yeah,
and campaigning organizations of that kind. And then the second half was more through Forum for the Future, which wasn't really activism as we would know it. But I'm coming out of that now, and I'm getting back into a much more explicit activist stance over the next however many years I have left to me.
Wonderful. Okay, good. Let's go back to the beginning then, because it sounds like you've come a full loop. But let's go back to, was it the Green Party, which was your first major role or engagement with?
Yeah. I joined the Green Party in 1974. Was lucky enough to read an extraordinary little book called Blueprint for Survival, published by the Ecologist magazine at that time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is so obvious, literal no-brainer moment of revelation for me, that we could not possibly go on trying to build a better world for humankind if we did it at the expense of the whole of the rest of life on Earth.
Yeah.
And even then, that seemed blindingly obvious. So I joined Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, the Green Party, pretty much all at the same time. The Green Party wasn't very big in those days. It was called the Ecology Party. And pretty soon by the 1979 general election, I was in a spokesperson kind of role, so could get out there and try and explain to people what the Ecology Party was all about, which wasn't always that easy, of course, because it wasn't a brilliant name for a political party.
Yeah, fair enough. What did you see then, back in, well, that 5-year period, 74 to 79, what did you see then that has actually manifested today? What didn't you see? And were you having any impact at all at that time? Like, was anybody listening to you? Did anybody care?
To be honest, I think most of my friends and colleagues thought that I was a bit of a nutter, and nobody was really talking about the environment as a big deal. We hadn't reached that point of awareness about some of the big issues like climate change, ozone depletion, rainforest, biodiversity loss. None of that stuff was going on in those days. So it did look to most people like a sort of bit almost whimsical approach to prioritizing what really mattered to me and to my community and to my fellow human beings. But I think, you know, it did change. And from the mid-1980s onwards, people really did begin to wake up to the degree to which we were just trespassing on the planet in increasingly destructive ways. Mm. And from the late 80s onwards, it was very different. Leading up to the Earth Summit in 1992, huge public awareness, growing attempts to sort out these deep economic challenges that we face. It hasn't made as much difference as I would have wanted it to, because we're still stuck in a dominant model, which is the only way to achieve progress for humankind is deemed to be through more and more and more economic growth. Every year. So it's going to be more growth. And that growth is increasingly undermining the ability to sustain life on Earth.
Mm. So thank you for that. And we'll go to the Friends of the Earth kind of section of your life in a minute. But obviously, just a couple of weeks ago, we had Rishi Sunak, you know, announcing that they were pulling back on, you know, kind of nearly all the legal agreements that they'd committed to. How did that make you feel? What was your? How do you feel when you get this kind of leadership response to stuff that you know is so urgent?
I'm very familiar with the notion of, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Mm-hmm. The problem with this government is it's two steps forward, three steps back, and I am enraged at the way in which the Conservative government today is undoing about a decade's worth of cross-party consensus about the need to drive a low-carbon, green economy, and to do it essentially by shifting away from fossil fuels and building up all the new sources of wealth around renewables, around efficiency, around different farming systems, different ideas about people's health, for instance, to take into account the massive impact of air pollution from burning fossil fuels. You know, tens of thousands of people killed in the UK every year through poor air quality, 7 million killed all around the world every year through poor air quality. So when we step back from those really critical shared priorities, which is what we've had in the UK for the last decade, not with much enthusiasm from the Conservatives, it must be said, but we've had that. When you hear politicians going even further back than that, it is really unbelievably disappointing. And yes, my go-to emotional response usually is beating my head against the wall and, I'm sorry to say, letting loose a lot of language, which we're obviously not going to use during
thank you,
because I've been put on best behavior when it comes to
well, we are live. We obviously, this does go out
absolutely
on the platform. But thank you for that. So when you moved from the Green Party to Friends of the Earth, you were actually taken on, if I remember rightly, as CEO or as kind of head person there, right?
Yeah.
And was that, well, as far as I understand, Friends of the Earth, although I didn't know much about them back in the day, they are pretty much a lobbying organisation, right? They kind of try and embed regulation into government. Was that?
Well,
was that
your... lobbying, campaigning at both the national and the local level. Right. And it is also now a very strong source of research into these big problems. So it has a huge commitment to bring you forward best science that we can on these problems. But in 1984, Friends of the Earth was at a low ebb, let's be honest. There were only 7 members of staff when I became director. The organization had exhausted itself in terms of a big, huge campaign against the nuclear power station, which is now Sizewell B, and had pretty much run out of money and had run out of energy. So I think for me, it was a brilliant moment to arrive. And I don't mean that as in it was good that Friends of the Earth was sort of down on its luck at that time. I mean it that allowed lots of chances to rethink things, to begin to look at new opportunities, start talking about different issues, internationalize the organization, to a certain extent professionalize it as well, to breathe new life into the local groups. The local groups and Friends of the Earth have always been its kind of lifeblood, and that was really critical at that time. And I had the good fortune to be there when environmental issues took off in the public domain, as it were. Mrs. Thatcher suddenly started to get very exercised about green issues around climate change and the depletion of the ozone layer. And suddenly everybody wanted to know more about what an organization like Friends of the Earth could offer. So it was a brilliant time to be there.
Nice. Well, I'm sure you had a lot to do with that as well. And whose ear did you have? I mean, you've mentioned, you know, Margaret Thatcher, probably one of the most important leaders of our history. Did you have her ear? Did they have?
Not really. No, not really. I mean, we were still considered by most people in politics then to be a pretty ramshackle bunch of activists. We had one tie, which was shared by all members of staff, and it used to hang on a hook near the door. So when we left to do our lobbying meetings with government ministers, wherever, we'd all grab the tie. And that was the only time we ever put ties on. But we did. I was pretty keen to make sure that the Friends of the Earth radicalism was not marginalized by people.
Mm.
I didn't want it to be sort of treated as an organization on the fringes. So we, bit by bit, we crept into this notion of respectable radicalism. And all the time we kept on going back to what the science said, And it worked. I mean, it did help build a different reputation for the organization over the 6-7 years that I was there.
It's interesting because I mean, if anybody hasn't heard the term, let's listen to the science in this global movement that we've just had with the pandemic, then you know, there's something wrong. But that I'm wondering whether nature is giving us opportunities to learn about ourselves, and you know, that be leadership, bureaucracy, corporations, the public, civil society, etc., etc. And I think we've just had a really big example of that with let's listen to the data, let's listen to the science. But I want to come back to that in a minute, because that's a modern thing. Where did you move from? Because I know you mentioned that you did kind of government. You were working with the government and advising governments, then big business. Was the government advisory role when you were Friends of the Earth, or was that something different?
No. That was later on. I became between 1990 and 2000. I was chair. Is that right? No, sorry. Between 2000 and 2009, I was chair of something called the Sustainable Development Commission. And that was set up by Tony Blair's government to advise many different government departments. We actually worked with 8 different government departments to advise on sustainable development. And at that time, sustainable development was a big deal. You know, we'd had the 1992 Earth Summit, and there was a lot of interest about how to turn sustainable development into an organizing principle, basically, for good governance.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The commission had a very significant role to play at the heart of government. And I don't regret a single moment of that. I learned a lot about the frustration of trying to get stuff done through government departments and all the attendant bureaucracy that goes with that. And sometimes it was very frustrating. But basically, that's what democracy looks like. You have to work with the will of elected representatives. You have to make sure that those democratic impulses are at the heart of everything you're doing. So there was no point kind of getting worked up about it. That's just the nature of government to a certain extent. But yeah, I am glad I'm really glad I had that sort of decade doing that. That was while I was at Forum for the Future. So it overlapped with the Forum.
Right. So it overlapped with the Forum, and then you obviously advising businesses and working with businesses that wanted to be more sustainable in their approach. So did the word growth, which is clearly the thing that is driving us to potential mass extinction right now when it comes to business, did the word growth come into it then? Because surely if people were dealing with, you know, a sustainable development approach to business and politics, then of course growth could have been done in a regenerative, responsible, you know, restorative way. Did that come into the conversation at all back then?
Well, not really. I mean, the debate about economic growth was far more lively in the 1970s and 1980s than it has been over the last two decades. And there were the publication of Limits to Growth back in 1972 shaped a whole period of time where academia, politicians, scientists, activists were all involved in the debate about growth. But no, latterly, it's been really difficult to get people to engage in the discussion about growth. Tiny insight into that. One of the best things that the Sustainable Development Commission could do was to publish a report on the compatibility between growth and progress. And we had at that time a very engaged discussion with the Treasury. The title of the report was Prosperity Without Growth. And Treasury civil servants refused to allow an advisory body to bring out a report with that title and insisted on putting a question mark after it. Prosperity without growth? Question mark.
Oh, no.
A brilliant piece of work by Professor Tim Jackson. And of course, as soon as he finished with the commission, he published it anyway without the question mark. But you can see how risk averse everything was, even at that time.
Yeah. Thank you for that. It's really, and you know what? When you said it, I was like, oh, that's fantastic. And then you stuck the question mark at the end. It's like, oh my God, it's killed it.
I know.
Okay. So, well, thank you for that. I mean, we are, as you know, everybody that's listening, we are going to have to go to a commercial break. So, Jonathan, let's hold that space for a moment. we'll come straight back to it. I know you've got a couple of songs that we're going to play, which are fantastic. I want to hear more about why you've chosen them. But for now, we're going to shift to a very quick commercial break, and I'll see you back here in a second.
Okay.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. As you know, I'm here with Jonathan Poet, who is a sustainability expert, has advised government, has advised big business, has started as an activist with Friends of the Earth, and is now getting back into a new stream of activism. But Jonathan, welcome back. I wanted to just pick up where we left off. We were talking about growth. We were talking about your work with the government and advising the government. But let's talk about the role that you've played within big business, because this seems to be one of the major, major issues of our current times, that big business seems to be running the world. They're bigger, they're more powerful, more significant, have more control than you know, nation states. So what was your work like in the business role, and how would you be doing things differently with businesses now?
Yeah, it's been a huge part of my life for the last 25 years, to be honest. I was at the Earth Summit in 1992 and was inspired to think about what the role of business might be. So came back to the UK and, together with different colleagues, was co-founder of two organizations, in fact, Forum for the Future and the Prince of Wales's Business and Environment Programme, both of which are still going strong, I'm happy to say. And the premise underlying both of those organizations is simple. Business is so powerful, you can't ignore them. You've got to be able to bring them into a state of heightened awareness about how much more we could be doing to protect the earth, to build better models of wealth creation. And if you can get business on side with that shared proposition, you can make real progress. And 25 years on from that, I feel that's been a really important part of what the green movement has been able to do collectively in the last two or three decades. I really do. And we've got hundreds of companies now that are lined up more or less on the side of the angels, rather than still being in the earth trashing business of maximizing profitability.
Mm, great.
So that's good. But more recently, I've come to the conclusion that however good companies are, even the best of those companies, until you change the rules of the game, and the game that we're all playing now is profit maximizing capitalism, you cannot expect business to be the radical force for good that they could be, because the rules of the game mean that if they step out of line, they get punished by shareholders.
Mm.
They suddenly find that boards of directors are getting quite hostile about some of the things they might want to do, particularly around social justice, supply chains, greater equity, different ways of reflecting the international obligations that we have. Those shareholder demands, shareholder first, fiduciary responsibilities can be crushing. So for me now, I want to get back into the business of changing the rules of the game so the businesses can actually do more than they're doing now. Because they are doing more than they did back in the 1990s, the first decades of this century, but they're not doing enough. And the only way to make them do enough is to change the law, to change the rules of the game so that they are all compelled to do more, basically.
Yeah. So this then goes back to government, goes back to legislation, goes back to government. Yeah. Do you think, I mean, just looking at businesses, for those of you that are listening that are involved in business, you've probably heard of the B Corp movement, which was, you know, I think initially inspired by the CEO of Patagonia and the way that they were operating in the world. Do you think the B Corp movement is something that is changing the way businesses look at themselves? And
the B Corp movement is a really interesting example of a very progressive approach to wealth creation. And in short, it obliges all companies to be as mindful of their environmental and social responsibility as they are of their financial and economic responsibilities. And it does really good work in that regard.
Mm.
But it is mostly a small company phenomenon.
Yeah.
There are very few large multinational B Corp. Well, there aren't any large multinational B Corps. You've got one or two companies who've made a part of their business in one part of the world a B Corp, but there's no, so far as I know, I don't think there's any multinational that's managed to crack the kind of governance challenge.
You're absolutely right. So what, thank you for that. And that's actually, I hadn't thought of it like that. Of course, there are brands or products within big organizations
that
become a B Corp, but not the whole organization. So what are you hoping to, or already engaged in that new kind of business evolution? Yeah.
Well, I'm not involved in, I'm still doing some business work with Unilever, for instance, as a big partner of ours in the forum. And I'll be pursuing that until the end of this year. But basically, I want to draw a complete line in the sand here. I want to reflect on those 30 years working with the business community. And I want to get back into campaigning work. So next year, 2024, is a critical year from an election perspective. I'll be doing a lot of work with the Green Party to help promote the really important campaigns that it has got. And I'll be working much more with more radical climate action groups, including Just Stop Oil, which I really want to try and help as much as I can. So I want to get back into being a clearer voice for radical change, because I think that's now what we need most in today's increasingly troubled world. And boy, is it troubled at every point.
It is. And we only have to, you know, look at the weather to realize, you know, the impact this is happening, you know, to us. It's happening to us now. Hottest temperatures on record, hottest temperatures in September, you know, 1.2 degrees temperature rise. We're supposed to not get beyond 1.5. I mean, clearly all this stuff's going to happen. There's no way on earth, is there, that we're going to be able to keep temperatures below 1.5. And that gets us to a point where it's unprecedented. We do not know what's going to happen with the weather patterns once we reach that temperature. So, okay, thank you for that. Gosh, there's so many questions bubbling around my mind. What I'd love to do, actually, is just for us to take a moment, and we're going to play one of your records. So we're coming up to more or less the midway point in the show. So you've chosen a song by Joni Mitchell. The song is called Big Yellow Taxi. We're going to play this song and then I'll come back to you, Jonathan, and you can tell me what it means to you, why it's the soundtrack for this particular subject matter.
Sure.
Oh, that line in the song, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. I mean, that's got to be one of the most poignant, you know, lines in all song history. What does that song mean to you, Jonathan? Thank you for bringing that to the show. What does it say to you, that song? Ah, we seem to have lost Jonathan. I'm going to carry on talking for a while until he comes back. Hopefully we'll be able to reconnect with him. So until we get Jonathan back, what I wanted to do is just speak a little bit today about some of the news that's happened since our last show. So as we all know, the Conservatives have had their, I don't want to sound like I'm trying to lead political decisions here, but the Conservatives had their conference. One of the things that I think was really important was there was a hand-delivered letter signed by 1,500 business people to key cabinet members, calling on them to take firm and swift action on the climate and nature crisis. The letter was actually handed to the Right Honourable Chris Skidmore by a gentleman called Ben Tolhurst, who is the director of Business Declares. Now, Business Declares is one of the organisations that popped up after Extinction Rebellion. And, you know, obviously people in business, people in various different sectors of the world didn't want to actually become, you know, on the street activists, but wanted to act and from their particular sector. So Business Declares is one of those. The letter itself asks the government to commit to investing in renewables, which we know is important, to take action to protect and restore nature, and most importantly, end new fossil fuel developments in the UK. So when Jonathan comes back, I'd like to talk to him a little bit about the Stop Oil crisis. Stop Oil movement, and obviously the oil crisis. It seems to me that every major sustainability leader, pioneer, activist, anybody that cares, realizes that the fossil fuel industry is perhaps the most significant part of the problem. Jonathan, welcome back. I'm sorry that we dropped you then for a moment.
I am back with you. Don't love Joni Mitchell so much that they chose to end the transmission at that point. I mean, she's such a brilliant musician and a great campaigner. But there's something so succinct about the message in that song, which is the idea of paving paradise to put up a parking lot. That's basically it. We've trashed nature to create an industrial society, which is so ugly and so damaging. And then the very plaintive line, you don't know what you've got until it's gone, basically. Mm-hmm. You don't know, you don't realize the significance of it until it's disappeared. And that, for me, is essentially what I've watched decade after decade as people have failed properly to value the natural world, the beauty, the diversity, the spiritual integrity of the natural world and our relationship with it, and have done it perhaps for, you know, understandable reasons, in order to drive economic growth to create the material standard of living that many people enjoy today. So for me, that pretty much sums up the decades of loss that we've had to...
Fabulous. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that very informative description of the song. How does it make you feel when you know, songs like that were written in another time that were poignant and clear on message? How do you feel about, you know, what does it stir up within you?
Yeah, well, there is a deep sense of loss about the damage we've done. There is a bubbling kind of cauldron of anger. I know I keep getting told that I shouldn't be so angry about what has happened, because to a certain extent, it was just people trying to make the best of difficult economic circumstances, deal with poverty and all the rest of it. And I feel huge sorrow for future generations, because, you know, our generation will probably come through the worst of this without actually understanding the extent of the damage we've done. Future generations will be picking up the price of this for decades to come. I mean, you were talking about the speed with which the climate is now changing all around us. I mean, the simple truth of it is that that's our physical reality. And we're going to live with that now for every single day of every single person's life in every single country on Earth. It's not going to go away. A disrupted climate, significantly disrupted climate, is now part of our reality. And that will impact more on young people in the future than it will much of the prospects they might have had for a better world in order to feed the furious wheels of consumption-driven growth. Crazy stuff, genuinely crazy stuff.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about Stop Oil, and thank you for that. I mean, I can really feel the passion and clearly understand the words. And why, well, I'm not going to ask you the open-ended question, why we're not changing. But let's talk about some of the issues. So we know that fossil fuel industry is, you know, probably the most significant negative impact on our global societal issues. You've talked about Stop Oil. I just wanted to share something with you quickly. I saw on social media, it was really awful to see, actually. The Stop Oil guys had gone out protesting. They'd stopped in front of a road, a motorway. I can't remember what it was. It's quite recent, actually. And somebody got out the car and started physically abusing them, kicking them and dragging them. And, you know, should have been absolutely, arrested by the police for that. Yet nothing was done. And I just thought, gosh, this is just insane. So what do you think about Stop Oil and the way that they're campaigning? And, you know, could they do things differently? Or is it just so important that it's the only way they can get out and campaign?
So their aim, this current campaigning, which is to make protests very visible, disrupt thing that you were just talking about, slow, is to attract media and essentially to make people have a choice to be by this, to decide which side are really in terms of equity, the injustice of our current system today. I don't agree with all the tactics of Just Stop Oil. I have to be honest. I've often raised that and I will continue to raise that. I think tactically, it's sometimes a bit inept.
I'm going to come back to you. There's a bit of an issue with the internet. I'm going to cut to a commercial break. I hopefully we'll get it rectified and we'll come back to you straight after this break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at WeightWatchers.com.
The station that makes you feel good.
Jonathan, welcome back. I'm sorry, we did lose you then just briefly, but I think we've got you back. We're solid and we're reconnected.
That's good. That's good.
You were just tying up the bit about Stop Oil and that you didn't agree with some of the ways that they're doing things, and then we didn't hear you. So what did you say just to wrap that bit up?
Yeah, I get a little bit worried that they're alienating more people than they're attracting to the cause, because the cause is so completely right. If we're going to get on top of this climate challenge, the first thing we have to do is to stop any new development in oil or gas. That's the key thing. That's what this government has betrayed now in terms of its recent decisions. So Just Stop Oil has the right objective, the right way, in my opinion, of articulating that objective. But I think the tactics are sometimes a little inept, if I can use that word.
I mean, you can understand it, can't you? Like, but, you know, we know what the issues are. We know we need to stop it. If the only way it is to go out there and cause disruption, then you can, you know, I totally get it. The problem, I think, is what you're saying is it does create polarization. It does create then a reaction to the activism, which then becomes reactivism, and it's just good.
It also plays into the hands of the predominantly right-wing media that we've got in this country.
Yes.
And they can take advantage of that then to continue to deny the significance of climate change and the horrendous impacts it's going to have on people alive today, let alone in the future. So that's my big concern, is further alienating those who it's really important start to sort of get engaged themselves.
Yeah, okay, great. I'm just really conscious of time. This has absolutely flown by. We've probably got another 7 or 8 minutes with you. So let's get into what people can do, what advice you would give from all of your learnings and your wisdom and your connections and everything that you've learned. What advice would you give people that want to come into this and campaign for a better world? Because I think everybody does. I bet 90% of people, if you ask them, they want to do something, but most people don't do anything because they don't really know what to do. So what nuggets could you give?
I honestly think the first story is, don't do what you need to do on your own. Find the right organization to do this with, either locally or nationally. I mean, there is so much going on at the moment, Jarvis. There are so many groups dedicated to one or another of these sort of big sustainability challenges, whether it's food production or healthy living or climate or biodiversity or, you know, bigger things like involvement in big international campaigns. Honestly, if you try and sort it out on your own, you probably are going to lose heart very, very quickly. So find your right soulmates, and that the solidarity that comes with that, the opportunity to do things collectively, is a source of joy as much as anything else. And we need that in our lives right now.
Find your tribe. I love that. Okay, so that's number one. Okay, find your tribe. Number two.
Number two. Don't turn away from the truth, because the truth of this is painful and people need to investigate it for themselves. They actually do need to do a little bit of homework on why climate change is such an unbelievably difficult challenge for us to deal with. Don't take it for granted. Dig into it a bit. Read the updates. Find out what the scientists are saying. I'm sorry. I know that's hard work, but it's unlikely that you'll see just how urgent a challenge this is unless you dig into the science a little bit and listen to what the scientists are saying. And yet, Jarvis, it is unbelievable. The last 6 months, the whole tone of the scientific community, the climate science community, has changed dramatically. They can't believe that we're seeing things go wrong so quickly and everywhere in the world. So get a bit of direct experience of that for yourself.
Yeah, and that reminds me, I remember at the last, it might have been COP26 actually, but certainly the IPCC, which is the Independent Panel for Climate Change, who bring out, you know, kind of pull all the evidence together.
you know, they said that I think for the first time it announced that, you know, this is certainly linked to human behavior, number one. Secondly, that if we don't reach our peak emissions, I think that by that it was 2 years, so it must be, we must be coming to that now, peak emissions, and then decline by 50% by 2030. Are those figures still relevant?
Well, they're still relevant. We're not going to make it, but they're still relevant.
So are you looking at, like, I know the UNR, because I did some work with them. Are you looking at less about mitigation now and more about how we actually deal with the changes that are going to happen?
Well, yeah, sort of. I mean, I've never really accepted this divide between mitigation and what's called adaptation. We need to do both, and we need to do both full on right now. And the amazing upside of doing what we can do about our energy systems is that if we focused on renewables, we focus on energy efficiency, particularly in terms of making good today's wretched housing stock for so many people living in fuel poverty. We just had a massive campaign to retrofit the disgracefully bad quality housing in this country. And then we started to press the button on new technologies around storage, different grid systems, and so on. Honestly, we could hit this target of a 100% new electricity system by 2035. We could get there. And if we can get there in the UK, trust me, then pretty much anyone, every other country in the world could map out a path for itself, which would get us there by 2035, 2040, whatever it might be. So I feel very bullish about that. And now that we know what the solutions look like, I want to keep on pressing the case for radical solutions to these problems that we face. And we've got to stay true to that, Jarvis. You can't give up on that. Yes, our lives are going to be disrupted. We will have to find routes to adaptation. Some countries will be much worse affected than others. But let's just hope we can stay on top of that.
Lovely. I think that's a really positive note to end on. And it's interesting, you're talking about actually, you know, quite, I know it's not simple, but let me use this term, quite simple things in a way. We know we can generate the funding. We know we've got the ability to be able to insulate, you know, use energy in a different way, et cetera, et cetera. If that's going to have such a fundamental impact on the world, how can people, just a last little note before you go, how can people get on board with that? Who would be the organizer? I mean, is it a case of voting differently at the next election? Is it a case of joining who? Who's gonna champion that?
Well, there are a ton of organizations out there doing this work locally and nationally, and Friends of the Earth is still there, Greenpeace is still there doing all this stuff. I have to say, if people feel they should be getting involved in the politics, next year is a hell of a good time to be doing it. Because you can't achieve everything we need to achieve in life without accepting political responsibility. I know that isn't everybody's cup of tea, but we sure as hell need to be doing that too.
Yeah,
and you can see how carefully I've avoided making a direct plug for the Green Party. But hey, I've just blown that one too. So there you go.
Jonathan, brilliant, brilliant. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. I could genuinely, we could talk to you all day. I think we're going to have to get you back on the show as well. Just a quick plug for you. You got anything that you're, you've got a book out? Hope in Hell, is that a book that people can still get hold of?
Yep, Hope in Hell, and it is as much, if not more, about the hopeful side of it than about the hellish side of it.
Yeah.
So go for that one. Yep.
Great. And if people want to connect with you, are you on social media or website?
Yep, I'm on Twitter or X, whatever you call it, only just because I hate Elon Musk, but there we go. So it's at Jonathan Porritt. But I also have my own website where you can read all my blogs and stuff like that. So that's www.jonathanporritt.com.
I did jump on there before you came on the show, actually, and I noticed you'd had a new blog up there just a few days ago. So you are keeping up to date with that. Jonathan, thank you so much. You will be writing for My Green Pod magazine in the next issue.
Of course.
And so look out for that. Thank you for joining us. And we'll love you and leave you. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great to share the time with you. Thanks a lot, Jarvis.
Thank you. So those of you that are listening, Jonathan Porritt, I mean, genuinely in my life, I remember when I first got into sustainability after the TV show that I was on, the Channel 4 series Dumped, where I had to live on a landfill. The first thing I did is came away and go, what am I quite good at? Who can I speak to that's going to give me more information? And what difference can I make in the world? And I ended up launching a magazine And I remember Jonathan, I was given a list of people that I should connect with, and Jonathan Poet and actually Tony Juniper, who is now chair of Natural England, they were both the two people at the top of the list. And this was back in 2007 when I first got my wake up moment. So it's an absolute honor to have, a real legend on the show. So thank you, Jonathan. Do check him out. Do connect with him. The other thing I must say to you is that I know this is not about nepotism, but, my company, My Green Pod, which my wife and I, it's a family run business. We've spent the last 15 years bringing information, writing content, writing features and articles and finding products that are better to use than the ones that are in the high street and in the supermarkets and often sold on Amazon. So if you do genuinely want to find out more, as Jonathan has said, go and get clued up, get the information. We've made it really accessible. So if you go to mygreenpod.com, there is 4,000 articles there on every subject matter when it comes to ethical lifestyle, restorative retail, sustainable business, campaigning, COP, the government, politics, the whole thing. So if you want to go and find out some more and anything that you're interested in, go to My Green Pod, go into the search engine, the search bar, and just put in any subject matter that you're interested in, from fossil fuels to cycling to organic food to sugar. It's all there. So that's what we've spent our last 15 years doing, all written by my very, very clever and intelligent and beautiful wife, Katie Hill, who is not currently doing the show with me, but once our 2.5-year-old is finally going to be going off to early school, then Katie will come and join me and actually talk about real news, because she's the person that writes it. I'm just the person that reads it and then tries to talk to you about it. So I just wanted to go back to what I was speaking to you about earlier on, which was this letter that was delivered to our current political leaders, the Conservative Party. This letter was signed by 1,500 businesses. And these businesses range from, actually not just businesses, people as well. So people like Deborah Meaden and Paul Polman, who was the former CEO of Unilever, is now an advisor to the government, you'll be very pleased to know. Dr. Bevis Watts, who is the CEO of Triodos Bank. Triodos Bank are, in fact, the most ethical bank in the world because they invest their money into social and environmental projects. So, also people like Dale Vince, who I'm sure you're familiar with, founder of Ecotricity. Rosie Brown is the CEO of Cook, and the, the most, probably one of the most important celebrities around at the moment, Chris Packham. This was a letter, and what it does, it went to the government. Now, what's really important about this is that the government, their responsibility, or they think their responsibility, is about keeping our country economically sound. And the way that it does that, of course, is by working with businesses, often big businesses, but it should be working with all businesses, and trying to make sure that these businesses continue to operate and pay taxes and give the government money in the country, right? So what's really significant about this is that these big businesses and individuals that are involved in business have actually, in essence, lobbied the government to really take on the responsibility of protecting and restoring nature and putting an end to new fossil fuel developments in the UK. So if anybody out there is interested in this particular work, then go to My Green Pod, have a look at the letter, work out whether you could write a similar letter to your local MP, figure out some of the things that you can do in your life that are contributing to fossil fuels. Here's a big one. If you work for a company and you have a pension, or you've ever had a pension, then make sure that that pension is actually moved from its current investment to an impact or sustainable investment. You can do this by going to Make My Money Matter We'll give you a list of ways that you can find out where your pension is, what it's currently funding, and how you can move it to a sustainable pension fund. Now, why is that important? Here's why. Pension funds fund the fossil fuels industries, just like they used to fund the tobacco industries back in the day. If you move your pension fund, it will have 21 times more impact than you becoming a vegan plant-based eater for the rest of your life. So that's really, really important. Also, if you can switch your energy tariff to one of the away from one of the big six, actually, and to some of these better companies out there that are really striving for renewable energy. So there's Octopus Energy, there's Good Energy, there's Ecotricity. You know, do that, because a lot of people are subscribing perhaps to a green tariff, but not realizing that the company that you're paying your money to for your utilities are actually still invested in fossil fuels and what we describe as brown energy. So we're going to end on that note. I know I've rambled on. Thank you very much for listening to me. Again, huge respect to Jonathan Powett for being this week's guest. I'm just going to very quickly close by saying and reminding you that the song that we've used to promote this show, Lean Into Clean, is a song called Save the World. I am the recording artist singing the song. It's a cover version of the Swedish House Mafia song. We're going to play out with this song, Save the World, by me, Jarvis Smith. But the reason I'm mentioning it to you, if you like the song or you feel like you want to support what the song is about, the song is a fundraiser for Greta Thunberg's Fridays for Future Mapper. Mapper means the most affected people and areas, the people that are most challenged, and the young people, should I say, that are most challenged by the issues that are occurring because of this now current climate crisis, biodiversity loss, pollution and toxicity. They're the three major issues. So please play the song Save the World by Jarvis Smith. Play it on Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, all of the tech companies. You don't have to pay to play it. They have to pay me because you've played it. If you can play it 10 times a day, we can rack up 100 million plays. We'll raise £100,000. If we can rack up 1 billion plays, we'll be able to raise £1 million to be able to donate. I've donated 100% of the money that I would get to this cause. Here it is. It's Save the World by Jarvis Smith. Please get this song played and into your playlist. Thank you for having me. I'll see you this time next week.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Comfort is often the first thing we're willing to give up. But don't let style be the reason you aren't comfy. Mack Weldon's Ace Collection makes it effortless to look put together while feeling truly comfortable. Inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, the Ace Collection combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks. Upgrade your collection for the new year with new bomber jackets, half-zips, sweats, crewnecks, and much more. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.